Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello, I'm Peter Johnson, Air Marshal Black Robertson, CBE, Bachelor of Arts, Fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. Black flew all the RAF's frontline fast jets and also qualified as a helicopter pilot, which is quite unique. He did 5 tours in Whitehall, which he describes as being a Whitehall warrior. Black has now retired and is the author of several books, including Fighters in the Blood, A Spitfire Named Connie, and Spitfires to Vampires and Beyond. Today we're here to talk about his latest thoroughly enjoyable book, Flying Through the Ranks. Black, it's an honour to have you join us today. Welcome to Extended.
Thanks very much, Peter. Delighted to be here.
Now, Black, before we get on to books, and I'd also like to ask you about your father. Where does the moniker nickname Black originate from?
You have to buy the first book for that. It's not publishable.
Right. Well, there you go. Let's park that one then and crack right on. One of the interesting things that I found out about you when I got the book and started looking you up is your father's career and how you came about understanding a bit more about what your father had achieved earlier in his life. Do you just want to explain that to our listeners? Because I think it's a fascinating journey.
I'd be delighted to. The thing about my father was he was like all his generation. They never talked much about what they did during the last war. He was decorated Spitfire ace. And he lost an eye. All I knew was that one of his eyes didn't work properly. He had a glass one, which he put in for the day and took out at night. He hardly ever talked about his flying career. If we ever did talk about flying, he'd turn the conversation to one of his heroes. And I suppose his first hero would have been Mick Mannock, the VC, who flew SE-5's 85 Squadron, I think, during the First World War. And then the man for whom he worked when he was on 72 Squadron, Biggin Hill, in the summer of 42, a man called Brian Kinkham. But I found all this out rather too late, really. As a youngster, I was sports crazy. And it was only through my father asking me one day what I wanted to do with my life that we really got to talking about the RAF. I wanted to become a professional cricketer. He said, "You'll make no money and you're not good enough. Any other ideas?"
Right.
You know, I was nonplussed, Peter. So I said, "Well, perhaps flying might be fun." And he said, "Join the RAF, go to Cramwell." And his reason for saying that was Brian Kinkham, the man I mentioned, was a Cramwell graduate. So Father's simple logic was, if you're going to be any good at this flying game, you have to go through Cramwell, the same way Brian Kinkham did. And that's what got me into the Air Force. But I left home at 18, having never really delved into Father's story. It was only after he died and he left some memorabilia, and after my mother died, 8 years after Father in 2007, that I picked up a whole bunch of letters, nearly 350 of them.
Wow.
And more memorabilia.
Wow.
That Father had written to Mother. It was only by going through all that I was able to put Father's story together. And there was a natural reluctance to read all these letters. A couple of reasons. I didn't want to invade pry into a teenage love affair, because my father met my mother when she was 12 and he was 18. And second reason, I didn't know what I'd turn up. So I was quite nervous.
No, so it's understandable.
It took me until about 2016, 17, 18 to even delve into the letters. And once I did, I realized I had a gold mine of primary sources there. And that's what led eventually into writing the first book. There's more to it than that. I didn't want to write about what I'd done. I don't get any pleasure out of talking about my own career. But once I learned so much about my father's, I suddenly thought the only way to tell my story, which I've been asked to do, would be to parallel my own with fathers and link up what I'd done with what he'd done. And I could then blame him for all my misdemeanors. He bent aeroplanes, so did I. He ran out of fuel, so did I. He was short-tempered, so was I as a young man. So they're all inherited limitations, you see.
But Black, let me just take you back a little bit. My father was in the Fleet Air Arm, not a decorated ace by any stretch of the imagination. But I went through a similar process of it was always in my life, but I never recognised it. Had a little chat with him about a few things, but like your father, he didn't really talk until the very end, just before he passed away, when he started to open up. And of course, once I'd got ready to listen more, he left us. I found that a terribly frustrating process. When you started to rediscover the life that he'd had and quite the character that he was, how did you feel? What sort of emotions did that bring to the surface? Because I've struggled a little bit with that.
The best way of answering that is the way my brother answered it. My father taped about 60-odd pages worth of material, 60 pages that my brother transferred from tapes, which were his recollections. When my brother's first son was born, my brother asked father to write something down about what he'd done so that he could give his own firstborn son in time details of what father had done. And father, you know, I inherited his lazy streak too. He decided not to write. He taped it all.
I don't think that's true, Black. I don't think that's true.
He gave it to my brother and it sat there for literally, I don't know, 7 or 8 years before my brother turned it into typed out recollections. And it was only when I read those, because I never listened to the tape, that I learned so much about him. And my brother's big regret was, well, first of all, it was an emotional experience. You imagine typing out your father's recollections when he's been dead for 8 years or so. I mean, it was quite cathartic for my brother, and it was cathartic for me to read what he typed out. And that's how I got to find out the sort of droll way my father talked about things. Well, he just literally sat in a chair with some notes, and I found those notes in his memorabilia later, and then dictated into this machine. And it's just like my father talking to me, and that it's just beautiful stuff to listen to. Yeah. And I say my brother was quite emotional. Tape, you know, listening to a man who's been dead 8 years, it's quite an experience.
Yeah,
I never did it. I only ever read it. So that's how it came about.
And how did your common love of flight come about? How did he transfer that to you? Was it just a DNA thing, or did he encourage you, or how did that happen?
It's a very interesting question. I don't know if it's DNA. He never forced me into doing anything other than that one remark I mentioned where he said, you know, if you're going to be any good, go to Crammel. I think we shared perhaps two characteristics above all else: extraordinary good fortune, and I can go into that in more detail if you wish, and a love of the fun, the sheer joy of flying. It was only something that I realized we had in common when I read all his tapes. He never ever sat me down and said, oh, you've got to be a fighter pilot or whatever. He was never like that. He was a man of few words, and he understated almost everything he talked about. So as far as passing it on to me, I don't think he did, other than that piece of advice, that if you're going to be any good at this game, you know, go to Crammel. And that's how it came about.
Right, okay. Now, that's all summarised in the book, the story of the Spitfire pilot and the son who followed in his footsteps. 60 pages of notes, probably some hearsay and myth and legend. How did you research all the other things that you then wrapped around that detail to bring that book to life?
I'd read a lot. So I had other books I could sort of correlate what my father had done. One example would be the man who took over from Kinkham was a squadron leader, Bob Oxpring. And he'd written a book called Spitfire Command, I think. And that correlated what father had done. So I had that. It's just, it's how anyone does some research. You know, you just, part of it, you get on the internet and you pull stuff off. That pictures too were very helpful. Yeah. I had so many pictures that father had. And then researching the individuals in those pictures helped me build the picture that I needed for the book. And then referring to the odd flippant comment he made. I mean, he flew with Bob Stanford Tuck.
Yeah.
And he regarded Stanford Tuck, and I'm quoting here, as very good. And that's high praise from my father.
No, well, that's quite interesting because we had his daughter recently who wrote her father's story as well. I say recently, gosh, it's a year or two ago. And it's a similar journey you went on, quite interesting. And he was a fascinating character too. When you look back and see those characters and that time, and of course we live in different times and can't pass our culture and our judgments of today on them, but how do you reminisce? How do you see how they operated and responded and developed in what was a pretty traumatic time in the world's history?
Again, that's an interesting question. And the first thing I'll say is there is no way that someone, you know, as old as me with different experience can pass any judgment on those individuals.
Yeah.
But what I did read was what we talked about earlier, the sheer excitement. And in my father's notes and what I read in his logbook and his letters, the sheer enjoyment he got out of flying and operating. I mean, there's a story about him. He flew with Bob Stanford Tuck the day Stanford Tuck was shot down.
Okay.
He flew with him in the morning.
Right.
And Helen Doe, who wrote the last book on Tuck, didn't know that. So we connected and I was able to pass information backwards and forwards.
Wow, wow.
But that particular day, Tuck grabbed father about, I don't know, 11 o'clock on a, I forget which day it was, but and took him off and they just went looking for trouble, basically. and nothing much happened. Tuck was on to all the sector controllers, you know, give me some trade. There was no trade. Father was pretty hacked off because he was due a 48-hour pass at midday and Tuck grabbed him about 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
So
he was like
that sortie ate into,
it
ate into father's weekend. So when they came back, Tuck was hugely frustrated. And so was father. Jumped into the car he, as it were, borrowed from his prospective father-in-law, drove off for his 48-hour pass, and only when he came back did he realize that Tuck had been shot down. But, you know, Tuck loved the excitement of it.
Yeah.
Father found he captured, it rubbed off on people like father. He flew with a number of Battle of Britain aces, I mean, people like Ginger Lacey, and they all had this common sense of enjoying life, having the ability to squeeze the absolute maximum out of every single day. And Kinkham has written some beautiful stuff about that, about what it felt like, how you squeezed everything out of every single day.
Yeah.
And father would say that they were all scared. It was just a matter of how you handled it. No one knew anything about PTSD in those days.
Yeah.
Or how to treat it.
Yeah.
But you asked about how it came across. It's impossible not to feel that sense of excitement about flying Spitfires on operations. I mean, can you imagine Tuck being frustrated that there's no fight going? He can't get a fight.
Yeah.
And there's a quote in my father's logbook where he says, "Lovely dogfight!" Exclamation mark. You know, the sheer excitement of fighting. You know, I would say fighting for your life.
Yeah, they
and
were.
That's how it comes across.
Yeah. Okay, let's see how that sort of transfers into to your journey. You went to Cranwell. How did you find that experience?
Absolutely loved it. As I said, I left home at 18, and that's one of the reasons why I didn't know too much about father's career, because we didn't talk about it. My brother, 6 years younger than me, spent much longer at home with and so knew much more about father. And my brother was able to help me. What was wonderful about Cranwell was everything was done for us in the sense that you did this in the morning, this in the afternoon. You had to get up by a certain time. It instilled discipline from minute one of day one. And I think that's probably all you can ask for.
Yeah.
We played lots of, I told you I was passionate about sport. You had fantastic sports facilities. And it was fun meeting other people, all going through the same process of learning to march, learning to handle a rifle for drill, and with the excitement of flying coming after a bit. That was really the third year where, we flew chipmunks early on, but only in the last year did you really focus on getting to the stage where you earned your wings on the Jet Provost.
Yeah.
The time went like a rocket. I made some fabulously wonderful friends who remain friends for life. You go through that process. And in fact, this coming Sunday, I should be having dinner with half a dozen people I joined Cranmore with in 1963.
Wow.
We meet once a year for dinner. Yeah. So, we all look a lot older, but we do reminisce.
You'll all be very familiar to each other, though, and that's the wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me come back to that flying talk about the chipmunk, the Provost, obviously quite a traditional route into flight. How did you take to flying? Were you a natural? Was it tough? Did you struggle?
I think natural pilots are very rare indeed, and I certainly wasn't one. I think I was distinctly average. My first problem was after about, the first half term flying chipmunks, I had the most enormous pain. After about 15 minutes in the air, I'd have to land because I had this awful pain across my forehead, splitting headache.
Okay.
Yeah. And the RAF were brilliant. They diagnosed a problem with my nasal passages, which they bored out with an operation in my almost first turn. And I never had any more problems. But obviously, that was causing the headache. And I was frightened to death that I wouldn't be able to make it because I'd be unable to fly. So once that was solved, flying, I just had to work hard. There's no question. If one's not supremely talented, and I don't think, as I said, many people are, for me, the secret was to work extraordinarily hard. And I was fortunate that there were times I found it difficult. I had a bit of a problem trying to learn to fly in instruments. And no matter how hard I tried, I wasn't very good at it. And then a fellow I knew quite well invited me for a beer. We knew each other through sailing. He lived off base. I drove out to his local pub. We had a couple of pints one night, and he talked me through the problems I was having. So without getting anywhere near an aeroplane, through lateral thinking, as it were, he talked me through a problem, gave me the confidence and the manner of understanding how I had to solve the problem, and I didn't look back from there.
Wow.
But those are the two things I think of most of all.
How wonderful, how wonderful. Now,
there were also some very good pilots on my entry and my squadron. So,
so there were some naturals,
No, I'm not saying natural. They were just very, very good.
Yeah. When I trained and I came, listen, I was a failed pilot, just a private. But when I came across pilots I thought were good, actually, you're absolutely right. They weren't natural. They were just good. They'd worked their way through it predominantly through study, through determination and through commitment. Whereas I just assumed it would come quite naturally. And of course, it doesn't, does it?
But there's more to flying than pure stick and rudder work. One of the most impressive sorties I ever flew in was sitting in the back of Ray Hanna when he led the Red Arrows, and I was going through NAT training at Valley.
Wow.
And to watch a man like that handle a 9 aircraft formation, low, tight, one maneuver after another, and to see how much spare capacity he had, I learned a huge amount about leadership. Just that was the most wonderful experience, to have the privilege of sitting behind Ray Hanna while he flies a show. It's unbeatable.
Yeah,
if you could bottle that and sell it, I'd be a very wealthy man.
Yeah, you certainly would. But you did get to fly, as I mentioned earlier, almost everything in the inventory, and you had the rare accolade as well, I mentioned, of qualifying as a helicopter pilot. Now, I won't go through every aircraft type that you flew, but there's probably a handful in there you'd single out as being your favourites and your less so. What were they in that journey?
I think the aeroplane I enjoyed most of all partly because it was a beautiful looking aeroplane and flew beautifully. It was a Hunter. Loved that.
Yeah.
Absolutely fabulous aeroplane.
Yeah.
The hour in the air I enjoyed most of all was probably in a Sea Fury.
Wow. Okay.
It's as close as I ever came to doing anything like my father did.
Yeah.
That was exhilarating. But to go back to where I started, I enjoyed the Hunter most of all. I flew most hours in the F4, and I had huge respect for it as a capable aeroplane. It could do absolutely everything. And that was massive fun. And when I was on 92, we had a small team that potted around Europe doing the odd show. And that was huge fun too. So Hunter, Sea Fury, Phantom, but there's no aeroplane that you fly you don't enjoy. None whatsoever.
Okay. Well, that's quite interesting. How did you get on then, what's the right word, migrating to helicopters? Because most fast jet pilots and a few we've had on here have said they wouldn't go near them, can't stand them, you know, a million parts all turning at the same time, death traps.
Interesting view you have there. Yeah, well, the way it came to me, I spent some time in Germany as a deputy commander, and I had the ability to fly virtually everything I wanted to. The Phantom was just running out of service as I arrived in Germany, so I got a bit of flying in that before it was retired. I then moved on to the Tornado, and I was traveling around Germany quite a bit in helicopters, and I thought, well, you know, flying Harriers and what have you, rather nice to try this helicopter thing. And it was extraordinarily difficult to start with. It really was. But it gave me a real feel for how the other boys earn their crust.
Yeah.
If you're a fast jet pilot and you switch to helicopters, it is a difficult trick to learn. It's not impossible, but you need to be taught properly, as I was.
Yeah.
And I developed a healthy respect for those people who flew helicopters. I'm afraid I indulged myself. That's all I've got to say. I had the ability to fly them, in the airplanes were there if I wanted to fly them. And if I could persuade someone to teach me to fly them, you know, how lucky can one get?
Did you know that in the late 1940s, during atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones? Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's solo Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
And you mentioned good fortune earlier, and I think I've read it a few times in some of the things you've written. It smiled on you. Can you share an example where luck and good fortune has come to your aid?
I'll give you two. The first one was the fact that the paperwork that went to Cranmore saying I got the right academic qualifications was in error. So I arrived at Cranmore without the right qualifications. They thought I'd got three A-levels. I'd only got one. And when they found out, I was ushered out of the group captain educator's office while he decided what to do with me. He called me back in and said, rather than put you in the top academic stream, we're going to put you in the bottom academic stream and see if you cope. So that was my first piece of luck. I was an error. The second piece of luck is something I have no idea how it happened. I'll try and keep the story as short as I can.
Keep it as long as you want.
I was ferrying one of three Hunters together with George Aylett and Tim Thorne back from Bahrain via Sharjah to the UK. And our first main stop was in Tehran. So there were three of us arrived in a break in the weather. At the same time, two 208 Squadron, I was on eight, 208 Squadron hunters came the other way. So you have five hunters arriving at Mehrabad Airport in really murky conditions after a pretty hair-raising instrument approach in their formation. I was the last chap to be picked up. It was dull, raining, cold, horrible. And so once I'd undone the underneath the aeroplane and pulled out my bag, a sort of VW combi van arrived with the other four pilots. And I opened the back, threw my bag in the back and climbed in after it. The BO, I think it was BOAC agent who was looking after us, a little Indian guy, said, "No, come and sit in the front, there's room here." I said, no, I'll jump in the back. There were no seats in the back, just bags. And I was quite happy to climb in the back and sit on top of these bags while the other chaps were sitting in the seats. The Indian insisted I got in the front. I equally strongly insisted I stayed in the back. Now, I mentioned earlier, I'm lazy. I am. Why did I turn down a comfortable seat in the front with him on a bench seat? I've no idea why. We drove away. The back doors are closed on me. We'd been going about 3 or 4 minutes when there was a scream from Tim Thorne, "Look out!" And then the most horrendous metallic tearing, crashing sound as we hit a sort of 16-ton Persian Air Force truck at 90 degrees. We rolled over, the back doors opened, out spewed the bags. I came out, you know, like a chap skiing down a mountain. I bruised my spine, but that was about it. The chap sitting where I would have been was very nearly killed. I believe he lost a leg.
Wow.
Now, what I don't know, Peter, is why on earth I insisted on, you know, taking the short straw.
Yeah.
Getting in the back wet without a seat.
Yeah.
But something inside made me climb in the back. If I'd been in the front, I could have been killed.
Wow.
Now, why that happened, I don't know. So there's my biggest piece of luck.
Wow.
Oh, and one more piece of luck. was to get as far as I did in the Air Force on a strictly limited supply of talent.
I'm not sure about that, Black, but let me challenge you a little bit, because you did have quite an exceptional career from most people's views. But you migrated, as we mentioned earlier, to some non-flying duties, should we say. And the challenges of working with politicians, how hard was it to protect the service from political interference?
Well, to get to the answer to that, you have to understand what it feels like to go from the cockpit to a ground job.
Yeah.
That's like crossing a Rubicon. And I think it depends on whether you get the right kind of ground job, whether you are prepared to, again, it's hard work, but some people find it difficult. I didn't find doing ground work particularly difficult, mainly because I got some terrifically interesting jobs. And if the job's interesting, then it's an easier job to do. You don't get to the stage where you're face-to-face with politicians until you're in the main building at a reasonably high level. Yes, and stuff trickles down and you get the feeling. But I never had to deal very much with politicians and protect the Air Force, as you say. That's really the job of the chief and the board. What you've got to be aware of is the political environment, what'll run and what won't run. There's no point pushing a program that patently isn't going to run, or pushing an idea that is going to be politically unacceptable. But again, the politicians I worked with were really pretty good fun. I can give you an example. It was around the time there were some good TV programs, and which will be relevant in a second. I was taken into a minister's office. I forget the name of the minister. Geoffrey Patty, that's who it was. Undersecretary for the Air Force or something. And he wanted to be briefed by a guy called Tony McKeon, a wing commander, and I, on the acquisition of a new fighter. And Tony went through this whole business, and I explained what I knew about it, because I was to deal with plans and procurement and what have you. And Patty said to me, so as I understand it, then, wing commander, it's blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah. And I said, "Yes, Minister." And when I said "Yes, Minister," Tony McKeon kicked me under the table because it was the classic time, you know.
Yeah.
And Patty, I think, saw the joke. And the other example of proving that ministers are really quite good fun, when Nicholas Soames was in the same position Patty was, I was called in, and we were talking about some bad PR that the services were getting. It was all to do with, I think it was soldiers on holiday in Norfolk riding horses through the beaches. And that was a reason for
okay.
it. And Nicholas Soames said, you know, this, it's important that the soldiers get some time away. I mean, it's like taking part in hunting and taking part in show jumping and riding and events. You know, they need to practice these things. Isn't that right, Wing Commander? I said, yes, it is, Minister. It's for the same reason that we fighter pilots need 2 or 3 days on the grass moor each year. Nice try, he said.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was pretty lucky. The ministers we had were pretty reasonable. And to go back to your question, I don't feel I ever had to protect the service, except in one instance, and that applies to all three services. Anytime there's a defence review, it's all about saving money. No matter what they say, it's about saving money. And so each service fights its own corner. And that's hard work. There were cases when I had to write a paper to produce a war roll for the Red Arrows because the Red Arrows were coming under criticism, costing too much money. Can we spare those sort of pilots? So in that sense, we had to protect. I'm going back to sort of early 80s, to protect the Red Arrows. I'm not saying the ministers were after them, but given a series of options, which was the least unpalatable?
Yeah.
And we had to make sure that cancelling the Red Arrows was the most unpalatable as far as the RAF was concerned, because if we believe that, and we did. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and thank goodness you did. Because they are still, you know, I've got a young daughter, and if we go to an air show, the Red Arrows are the star. You know, my wife, are the Red Arrows going to be there? You know, so it's still really, really important for those youngsters to have that routine to the service by that demonstration. And, you know, yes, it's a marketing ploy, call it what you want in the modern world, but we need it because otherwise they just don't get to see it. But interesting stuff. Let me bring you back then to writing books. Let's come to your latest book, Flying Through the Ranks. I enjoyed it. I felt it was a very different approach to a way of bringing a lot of stories together from various levels in the Air Force. I mean, love the Cold War, love anything about the Gulf War because I was brought up for it. But where did the inspiration come for you to write something and synthesize it down into the way that you have?
Well, everybody who's flown airplanes has got a story or two tucked away, probably 3 or 4. And I knew this, and I'd written 3 other books, and I wanted to change something, to do something different. And the idea of putting together these stories came to me because all the stories I'd read were either based on an aircraft type or a time, a Cold War. So I thought, well, let's try a slightly different approach. Let's try and get something from every single rank, from the highest to the lowest. And that's where the challenge lay, because there aren't very many marshals of the Royal Air Force out there.
Yeah.
And at the lower levels, both commissioned and non-commissioned, you don't stay in the low level very long. So the chance of having stories from there would be limited. And the Air Force has got a sort of a pyramid type, a rank pyramid, which is fatter in the middle and narrow at the bottom and narrow at the top. So what I was hoping was to get a couple of people of every rank. And of course, it didn't quite work out like that. I've got more of the fat middle and the fewer of the top and the bottom. But what I wanted to do was to get people to tell me their stories, looking way, way back. And so you have, you know, the Lord Stirrup, the one who wrote the Marshal of the Royal Air Force chapter, going right back to his youth. And at the other end of the scale, you've got a fellow who retired as a junior technician, telling you stories about when he was really, really young. And that the idea of having every rank tell stories brought a second element to it, which was to link the flying with the ground side of things, because none of us would be in the air if it weren't for the skill of our engineers. None of us were sitting on a ejection seat unless it was properly serviced, and we knew it would work by people in the Air Force, yeah, and by Martin Baker, of course. But
yeah,
so I wanted almost to make sure that there was a tribute to the ground people, without whom none of us would ever get airborne as well.
Yeah.
And very fortunate that people were prepared to tell their stories.
How did you find them, though, Black? Because it's a very, diverse is the right word, but it's a real mixed group. You must have really worked hard to find some of these people.
Well, at my age, I know a lot of people. And so if you ask a few of your pals to see if they've got the stories, they often pass you on to somebody else. And I found a lot of the ground crew stories through connections I'd had when I ran 92. A lot of the airmen there had other connections. And I there were a few on Facebook I'd sort of conversed with, if that's the right term for talking on Facebook. One in particular, Ray Deacon, who's got a tremendous hunter background. I naturally had an affinity for him, and he helped me hugely with that. Okay. So, and some people did need some persuading. Some people refused. They had their own books in them, they decided.
Okay.
And some people, I think of one, who said, well, I may have one story. I'll think about it. And he came up with an absolute corker, wrote it beautifully too.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's brilliant. did you like it? He said. I said, I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And about three or four weeks later, he came back with a second and then a third. So people were able to tell stories that they'd hidden for years.
And yeah,
the book is a way of allowing them to have that privilege.
And they're quite, listen, there's a lot of content out there on the Cold War, but they're all pretty original, actually. They're really original. I was unfamiliar with everyone. So everyone was a page turner, which is always nice, because sometimes in a book you sort of get excited at the beginning, you get into the middle, and then you have an exciting end. But actually it was a nice, easy page turner, because every story had its unique focus. But one of the things that the book does focus on is risk, and an awful lot of lessons learned, and not ignoring the risks at your peril. Following your father's footsteps, did you feel like the pressure was greater on you? You know, that whole risk environment that we're moving into through that whole Cold War and into today, of everything's a risk, let's calculate it. Whereas your father grew up in a very different world.
It never crossed my mind, but it does bring out a story about risk and my father, which I found out afterwards. I'll run through that very briefly. He went to his first squadron in October of 41. He fully expected, having completed the Spitfire OCU, or OTU, to end up being posted to Scotland or possibly north of England. Never expected to be near the heart of the action, which is what happened to him. He got sent to 111 Squadron at North Weald. He arrived one afternoon, got the lay of the land, found out next morning he had a squadron commander's interview at 8:30, got his room in the sergeant's mess, chatted to a couple of chaps from 111, had a beer and supper. And there he learned that because he was non-operational, there was no requirement on him to spend the night on base. Without a second's thought, he was out through the main gates of North Weald like a shot from a gun, hitchhiked his way down to my mother's place, which was about an hour away. Got up at the crack of dawn. He spent the night there, of course. Got up at the crack of dawn, hitchhiked his way all the way back to North Weald in time for his interview with Squadron Leader G.F. Brocci. And when I read this, I couldn't believe it. But the risk thing you talked about then comes into focus. It was a calculated risk. Everybody who flew fighters, taking a risk was natural. But it suddenly occurred to me, and quite late on, that my father was a risk taker, but he took risks in a calculated fashion. And that's the best example I can give view of that. And I think that's the key to succeeding. You need a degree of aggression as a fighter pilot, I think, but which is, a wife once explained it to me beautifully when she said, you know, what sort of qualities do you want in your young men on the squadron? And if you'll excuse the words, I explained it to her and she said, now, so I've got this right, Black. What you're saying is you're looking for a calculating ripshit. And I said, you've got it exactly right. I've never thought of putting it like that. So I never felt any pressure to emulate my father. I was at Cranwell, one of my closest friends there. His father was a decorated, I think he'd been a flying boat captain and had a DFC. And that really impressed me. But for some reason, the fact that my father had been decorated, was an ace and had a DFC, almost slipped into the background because I never knew much about it. But I knew about this chap's father. So my father was good at never creating any pressure. The only pressure he gave me was when he turned up when I was playing cricket, because I usually got naught when he turned up. I always felt the pressure
always works
too well when he was there, and I never did.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. Do you, in the world that we're in today, where you know you've seen technology go from manual flight to automatic flight, and in this world we're in today of artificial intelligence and all the other data-driven solutions we have, do you think that that's taken away all that risk and technology's taken that over in the fighter pilots of today?
I don't know if it's taken away risk, because I haven't flown the, you know, our latest airplanes.
So I understand, yeah.
What I think has happened is that people now have to spend more time planning and preparing a sortie, and a lot of it is done electronically. And the airplanes are incredibly easy to fly by comparison with years ago. But all the risk of flying the airplane on its own has been taken out. Not all the risk, but they've minimized it.
Yeah.
Fly-by-wire, a modern... I mean, the F-35, I gather, it is very easy to fly. Some other airplanes weren't perhaps as easy to fly, but might have been easier to operate. With the F-35 and modern airplanes like that, the technology required for you to fly a complex mission takes a huge amount of planning. And if you plan it properly, you're obviously minimizing risk. But risk comes in different ways. How you handle bad weather, how you handle running an emergency that you hadn't thought about. And that comes back to training. So that when something goes wrong, you revert to the trained individual, which is a way of mitigating risk. You can't, like telling your child to be careful when they drive your car. Yes, they can be, but you can't mitigate the risk of somebody else acting like an idiot driving into her or him.
Yeah. So
it's a difficult question to answer.
So that bit of advice your father gave to you when you said, what shall he do? And he said, go to Cranwell. Let's just say a child, a grandchild, a relative came to you now. What advice would you give to them?
With the same sort of question, what they would do with their life.
Yeah.
I got close to this a few years ago when my nephew was at Newcastle University on the Air Squadron and asked whether he should join the Air Force. And after a while, I said no, and he couldn't understand why, and I had to explain. I said, look, you're a South of England rugger player or a South of England cricketer. You'll probably get more time off to play those sports with the army, and you can fly helicopters, and they're pretty good fun. And all the decorations go to helicopter pilots these days. So in your position, what I would do is join the army. So he became an architect and moved to Singapore.
Goodness me. Goodness me. There's a left field example then. Thanks for that, Black. And just, I suppose, in summary, flying through the ranks, the book brings such a diverse group of stories, such a diverse group of individuals. How do you look back on your, which is your flying career, your RAF career? It's not all flying, but how do you look back on that career? What do you think are those key milestones that you look back on with fondness?
A number of things. I mean, the first time you fly a single engine fighter, the Hunter, was just the most magical moment, and I'll always remember that. I'll always remember the people, and there's an element of this in the book, who taught me, the people who tolerated, you know, idiot doing things wrong regularly and not understanding what he's told, the tolerance people gave me, the good instruction I got, the privilege of, I enjoy flying in America because Vietnam had just finished and I flew with a number of people who'd just come back from Vietnam. And there were some very, very good guys there who were pretty relaxed about things, even though, you know, life could get tensed. And I learned lessons from them. And I think the most privileged position I ever had was to run 92 Squadron when I had the most brilliant bunch of air crew and ground crew. And I learned so much from those ground crew. We were supported incredibly well by brilliant engineers, brilliant airmen with character. Flying the F4 and the low-level defense role in Germany was, you know, about as much fun as you can get at that time of the Cold War. And I'll always look back on that with massive privilege. An example of how well we were supported. We were off one weekend for a weekend's display in both, I think it was Norway and Denmark. The ground crew all traveled by coach, and we lobbed into somewhere like, I don't know, Aalborg. And I was strapping in for the Norway display from Aalborg on the first day, talking to the ground crew who strapped me in. I said, you know, everything okay? He said, oh, yeah, fine. In fact, you know, lovely. Hazel brought me a cup of tea in bed this morning. Hazel brought you a cup of tea in bed? What had happened was our engineering warrant officer, who was in charge of the coach, knew full well that a whole bunch of airmen off for a weekend would be untrustworthy. They'd go and drink too much and have too much fun. So what he did was he smuggled his wife onto the coach and took her to the base where we were staying and made sure that she literally tucked them up a bit at night and they were up, ready to do their job in the morning. And I thought that demonstrated to me a level of risk mitigation that I hadn't really perceived. Brilliant. And a level of sheer enjoyment. You know, there's no way I was going to complain about the fact he'd done something illegal. I thought it was absolutely lovely that he'd done that.
Example
of the quality of the people we had. So, you know, that sort of thing. I'll go back one stage when you talked about the book and what it meant about bringing people together. There's an example from one of the airmen who wrote stories for me, which summed almost everything up about flying in the RAF that in a way I'd never thought about it. This character was saying, you know, he really valued the relationship he developed with the pilots he's strapped in, the navigators he's strapped in, and being able to chat to them and talk about issues. A lot of the airmen have the same sort of, who've written stories, have come up with the same story. And then he said this. He said, every time I get down from that cockpit and I wave that pilot off, you know, I look him in the eyes, because one day, one of those pilots, you know, someone like me, will be the last human being he sees. And I suddenly thought, what a profound comment.
Yeah.
That relationship, that ground crew, air crew relationship, summed up in that wonderful phrase. And I took my hat off to this bloke for realizing it. And I'd never even thought about it.
Yeah. Wow. Powerful stuff. Powerful stuff.
It is.
Listen, Black, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thought we'd end up talking about the book, but we've covered your father, your career and everything. Really, really grateful for that. I've really enjoyed the opportunity. But more importantly, where can we find out how to get a copy of the book and where can we follow you online?
Well, I've got a website, www.blackrobertson.com, and you can message me through that. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn.
Okay.
That website's a good way of connecting to me. And you can also, of course, buy the book through Amazon or even Grub Street.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll put links to your website and social media, Grub Street, as well in the show notes. That's it. Black, it's been an absolute privilege. Thank you so much for your time today.
Peter, nice to talk to you. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
That's it. We'd like to thank Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historium for their support, and we'd also like to thank White Hearts, of course, for our music. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on social media, and you can find Ellie, Tim and Gareth on the extended social feeds on Instagram, Facebook, Threads and Twitter X. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Black.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.